and to council for coming. I know four of the five of you have come from Cortez and Dolores, and I know that you initially filed a motion to vacate oral argument, and in another case we might have been more receptive to do so, but because of the importance of the issues presented in this case, we thought that it was important to have oral argument this morning. And as you know, we entered an order allowing 20 minutes for each side for oral argument. So I just want to express on behalf of my colleagues that we do appreciate your coming here from afar. Also, I want to ask, is the attorney for the county, how do you pronounce your last name, please?
Slough.
Mr. Slough, it appears that you, we had discussed it somewhat in jest about having a third table for you, because it appears that you're on partly in an appellant and partly an appellee. So I just wanted to ask counsel before we get started if you've discussed among yourselves how you wish to divide your time this afternoon, and in particular, Mr. Slough, with regard to your time.
It's my understanding that I'm going to have 5 minutes. So that's not what I understand.
Okay, and could the rest of you indicate to me what your thoughts are?
Yes, Your Honor. Cameron Seekers on behalf of the Natural Mud Appellant. We kind of talked it over between the three of us, and they elected that I would proceed first, take about 5 minutes, and then Mr. Kelly, on behalf of the father appellant, would take what time he needed, up to 5 minutes. Mr. Slough would then finish up, and then I think we wanted to preserve 5 minutes of the 20 to respond to what the appellees had to say after the conclusion of their arguments, if that's appropriate.
Sure. Very well. And on the other side?
Garrett Semirick, on behalf of the interveners. Mr. Shaner and I discussed that I would have 15 minutes. Mr. Shaner would have 5 minutes. Mr. Shaner is the guardian line of the child.
Okay, very well. I appreciate your informing us about those time allocations, and I will try and keep tabs of those as we go along. And of course, you, based upon questions from the court, there may be some slight modification of that, but we'll try and allow you to adhere to your proposed times. Let me just review our procedures briefly for you. Normally we have 15 minutes per side. As I mentioned, we have 20 minutes for each side for oral argument. There's a digital timer that indicates how much time you have left. When there are 5 minutes left, the color-coded timer will change from green to amber, and when your time is up, the timer will turn to red. You should be aware that the judges have had a chance to read the briefs in this case, and at least one of us has had an opportunity to review the record. In light of that, you may wish to focus your argument on the legal issues rather than on the facts of the case, but of course how you present the argument is up to each of you. You should also know there's a toggle switch on the podium that you could use to raise or lower its height if you so choose. You should also know that the oral arguments are placed on the internet, so if you have any confidential or private information, you may wish to be careful as to how you referred to that during the course of the oral argument. And finally, I would ask everybody in the audience, including the attorneys, that if you have a cell phone, to double check and make sure that it's turned off or in vibrate mode so that it doesn't inadvertently go off during our oral argument. So with that having been said, we're now ready to proceed. And if each of you could introduce yourself for the record at the beginning of your argument, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. So for the record, Cameron Seacrest, attorney for the appellant Natural Mother, Ms. April Coleman. A quick introduction of my client sitting right behind me. Your Honor, I'm the attorney from Dolores, if anyone was curious. And it was difficult to find my way to this particular location. So I thought it was a success just to be
here. Denver was easy, but the courthouse was hard to find.
Your Honor, thank you very much for formulating a specific issue that you desire argument and comment upon. That issue briefly restated as, did the tribal court commit prejudicial
reversible error in allowing the foster parents to intervene in the termination of parental rights hearing at the lower court. The foster parents, represented by Mr. Tim Eyrick, and their legal arguments promoted by the guardian ad litem, the intervention right was a statutory right relied upon by the foster parents, and that's found under Title 19.3, 507, subparagraph 5. That statutory right is in the initial stages of a dependency and neglect proceeding. After the petition has been filed, the adjudication has been made. But prior to the disposition, the state legislature has stated that if a foster parent has had the foster child in his or her care for 3 months or more, that they would be able to intervene at that stage and be able to offer testimony and provide information to the court as to the disposition. It is the position of the appellant natural mother that that is the only statutory scheme, and that is the only authorization for foster parents to intervene by interpretation of case law and or statutes.
Mr. Sekulis, let me interrupt you right there then.
Yes.
It's true that 19.3507 says what you said.
Yes.
The 19.3502 subsection 7, which is also in the dispositional section, says that the foster parents are entitled to notice, as well as the pre-adoptive parents' relatives. Such person shall have the right to be heard at such hearings and reviews.
Okay.
Does that phrase over there, hearings and reviews, encompass all the hearings under the code, or does it only encompass the dispositional hearing, and do we have any authority on that point? How do we deal with that language?
Your Honor, it's a due process procedural requirement allowing one to have to be able to represent their interests. I just think that the notice, it does not rise to the level of a party status, if you will, of being an intervener.
Let's say more than that. It says they shall have the right to be heard at such hearings. One sentence says notice, and one sentence says they shall have the right to be heard at such hearings.
And once again, is the right to be heard analogous to the next stepped up level of being a party or an intervener? I think they have the right to be present. The judge may ask for their input, but it is a lesser status than the power of an intervener is my quick response to that.
Authority that you found that helps us on that?
Judge, I did not find any authority on that, and maybe my co-appellant counsel will be able to comment. But
I'm not saying there is. I'm just asking. Thank you, counsel.
No. And I think it's important to make a distinguishment here that what we're dealing with under the termination of parental rights is a separate act in and of itself. And of course, that begins at CRS 19.3601 at SEC, known as the Parent-Child Legal Relationship Termination Act of 1987. So I think that it's important to make a clear distinction that that is separate and apart from the statutory scheme by which the foster parents intervened into the dispositional phase of the case, and they're trying to argue to this court that that gives them the right to participate in the termination proceeding itself.
Mr. Sekulis, what is your view then as to the extent to which foster parents should be able to participate once they've intervened?
Then, if they on the statutory right to intervene, they would then have the ability to, as an intervener, to provide witness information to the court as to a proper disposition of the minor child or children involved. There'd be an information base that the court could draw upon based upon their 3 month or more relationship with the child.
But not to take an advocacy position?
Absolutely not.
Okay. You're just past 5 minutes, so if you want to cede your time to your co-counsel, it's time.
All right. Time passes by quickly.
Indeed it does. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'd like to introduce the father respondent over to my right on the first row. I would like to begin with by addressing the two questions that the court had answered.
Excuse me, would you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Terrible, sorry, Your Honor. John Kelly, I'm the attorney for the father respondent. The court inquired, first of all, what does an intervention look like, and secondly, to what extent does the intervener foster parent have a right to participate in the hearing? The district court judge in AWR 17-3-192 that I believe this court looked upon favorably, I think set forth what the father's position would be. And they said in that case, while confirming the foster mother's intervener status, the juvenile court ruled that the foster mother's participation in the permanency planning hearing would be limited to her own direct testimony as to the child's best interest. It further ordered that the foster mother could not present other witnesses or evidence, examine or cross-examine any witness, or make any motions, objections, legal argument. I would submit to the court that if what the district court judge in that case had articulated, that would protect the liberty interest of the father and the parties in this case. This court,
Mr. Kelly,
yes, sir.
But why then the distinction in the statutes between allowing a foster parent to be heard, as in 502.7, I believe that Judge Richmond mentioned, and then a statute allowing the foster parent to intervene? And typically we think of an intervener as the equivalent of a party. So why would the statutes treat foster parents differently in these circumstances unless it intended for the foster parents to have more rights when they intervene than when they're just to be heard?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the answer to that lies with the recent Supreme Court case earlier this year that affirmed the idea that a dependency and neglect case cues constitutional concerns. There's a 1982 case of McCall versus District Court in and for Montezuma County that states that the county attorney has the exclusive authority to bring a dependency and neglect action. And there's a subsequent case that says the guardian ad litem has the right to bring a motion for termination, but that is simply because they're acting as an agent of the state on behalf of the child. The situation here is that the parents have a fundamental liberty interest in continuing a parent-child relationship by allowing a stranger to the case full participation rights. That's infringing on their fundamental liberty interest, a violation of due process. It's getting away from what the court has previously indicated, that there must be strict adherence to the statute. The procedures in the statute must be strictly adhered to. The problem here, and I'd like to use the analogy of a criminal case, because the Colorado Supreme Court recently drew quite a few analogies between these and a criminal case. In a criminal case, you have the district attorney is responsible for prosecuting the case. A district attorney may decide not to prosecute. A district attorney may decide to proceed with lesser charges. Here we have an independent third party who does not have a fundamental liberty interest at stake intervening and attempting to take away that fundamental liberty interest. In our statutory scheme, the decision whether to prosecute or not prosecute, determine a motion to terminate, has been granted to the state. Here we have strangers to the family intervening and attempting to take away a fundamental liberty interest that belongs to the parents. And when the field is wide open like this, I think that we're getting away from a fundamentally fair proceeding. And this is a problem that is systemic to the entire trial and has resulted in a structural error. And therefore, both parents, the decision as to both parents should be reversed.
Mr. Kelly, before you, I have one more. Reading the trial court's order here, I really can't see in looking at that order what the participation of the foster parents had to do with the ultimate outcome. I mean, I see it looks like a pretty standard you know, run-of-the-mill, here are the factors that I must consider, here's the evidence, none of which was all the doctor this and doctor that. And so how was your client harmed by virtue of the foster parents' participation here?
Your Honor, I think that what this has done is it's turned this case from a question of whether or not the statute dictates that this is one of those cases where their liberty interest should be terminated, and has introduced this third party into the case and created this adversarial position that the statute didn't contemplate. So as opposed to simply just having the state attempting to terminate, we now have the state opposed to termination, at least with respect to one of the parents, and we have the this party in here that doesn't have a fundamental liberty interest at stake in a contest. I mean, it suddenly has become a custody contest, if you were, between these two parties, one of whom doesn't have the same constitutional issues at stake.
Before you leave, I'm sorry, Mr. Kelly, I'll ask a question, and maybe Mr. Slough can answer it as well. You acknowledge that the foster parents have a right to be heard.
Yes, sir.
They have a right to testify.
Yes, sir.
Where do you cut them off? What can they testify to? They can testify that the child, for example, was returned by the natural mother. He was dirty, he was unclean, he was sick. They can testify to that, right? When does that testimony begin to become, quote, adversarial to the mother? And when? How does the judge know when to cut it off?
Well, Your Honor, I think to answer that question, I would go back to that ARW case, 17 Pacific 3rd, 192. There, the court strictly limited the foster parents' intervention to exactly what the statute said that they could do, and that was testify as to the child's best interest.
The statute says concerning the care and protection of the child. That's what the statute says.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Best interest is a looser standard, I think, maybe than that.
Well, and Your Honor, I guess I'm not using that as a term of art. I'm using that just to summarize exactly what you had had indicated there. But when the foster parent examines, cross-examines, makes arguments, makes motions, makes objections, all those kinds of things, that's when I think that the line has been crossed and the due process, fundamental liberty interests of the parents have been violated.
So they can testify, but their attorney shouldn't appear. I shouldn't argue the case.
Shouldn't argue, shouldn't cross-examination, all those kinds of things.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Sauer, it's your turn.
May it please the court, I'm Bob Schlau, Montezuma County Attorney, on behalf of the people. Basically, the question, how do foster care providers acquire the right to advocate for the termination of a constitutionally protected parent-child legal relationship? The way a foster care provider comes into a case is that the court and the department have removed a child from the biological parents and placed them somewhere. And because this foster parent, whatever case it may be, presumably has some type of contractual relationship with the department to provide foster care services, then the court and the department place this child for foster care services with these contractual persons who are being paid to provide a foster care service. Now, the law requires that the department and the court try to reunify the parent and the child if possible. And so during that time, the child has to be taken care of, and so this is what the foster care providers have contracted to do. And human nature being what it is, while these cases are going through the court, people tend to become attached to children. So at some point then the foster care provider decides that, well, I don't want this child leaving. I want to keep this child. So the foster care provider suddenly then has this personal desire that's in direct conflict with their contractual duties to provide foster care services to the department and the court.
Of course, the contract doesn't limit. You could put in your contract, you may not appear in these hearings, you may not seek to adopt the child, but you don't have that in your contract, I take it.
Well, the idea that there's a, somehow foster care providers suddenly can oppose the people and the Department of Social Services in trying to reunite, which is what the duty of the department and the court is, if possible. Now, they are, the foster care providers are trying to prevent that. And it's my position that the, this is a corrupting influence on the integrity of the judicial process, when the integrity of the judicial process is supposed to be trying to reunite if possible, and that's what we're still trying to do. That's why we're here today.
Mr. Slough, the legislature has just said the foster parents are entitled to notice. They're entitled to a right to be heard. And at least at the dispositional stage, they're entitled to intervene. So the legislature must have contemplated some role for the foster parents besides taking care of the child.
It doesn't say that they have the right to advocate for termination of a constitutionally protected parent-child legal relationship. And so if we just look at the specific words in the statute, we can't put those words in there because they're not there. So if you just say, okay, the statute says, well, they have a right to notice and they have a right to appear, and certainly the AWR case, I think, said that they have a right to testify, and I agree with that. I'm not opposing that. But in answer to the court's question about, well, where do you draw the line? Well, obviously, the court did draw a line in the AWR case, and the courts, of course, that's what courts have to do, is draw the line in any given case, and obviously an objection by the people or whoever, the court has to decide, well, is that the place to draw the line or whether it should be drawn a little more down the road. So this is a, there's no bright line in terms of, like in most things, the court has to decide, obviously, but it's my position that this is a corrupting influence on the integrity of the judicial process for the purposes of going through, trying to reunite if possible, and having the foster parents advocating for termination, and I think that this is this influence can actually not only corrupt it in this case, but it can, once the foster parents become aware that they can advocate for termination, there'll be a lot more of it. And unless the courts are going to just allow it carte blanche, which I think is a terrible mistake, but I think that this is a corrupting influence on the integrity of the process.
What relief are you requesting then? What should we do? Assuming we agree with you.
Well, I'm requesting that the court reverse as to the mother, because I think it's our position that she's entitled to be reunified with the child. Now, the problem with the father, this is the Gordian knot here, because there's a constitutional issue involved, and constitutional issues apply to the guilty and the innocent constitutional rights. And this is a real problem, and so I'm just really torn about this situation, because if I say, well, they're okay, you know, it's okay for the parent to argue in terms of termination as to the father, then that's not being faithful to the constitutional requirement that I'm advocating. So I guess that as far as the mother, reunification, as far as the father, perhaps a retrial.
And what role will the foster parents be allowed to play in the retrial? Just witnesses.
That is the testimony as to the actual facts, and the court, of course, has to decide based on objections.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slough. The appellants have a minute and 9 seconds left, and I recognize that you had hoped to have 5 minutes left for your rebuttal, but as I mentioned at the outset, we would try to assure that you'd each have 5 minutes, but we can't adhere to that precisely because of the nature of questions. Okay, Mr. Eyrick.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Steve Eyrick. I'm an attorney with the Rocky Mountain Children's Law Center, and I represent the intervening foster parents. The foster parents' full participation in the termination hearing created no due process violation. Their participation is grounded in the statutorily accredited interest in the care and protection of a 2.5-year-old child who had been in their care for the majority of his life, and is consistent with a lengthy history of Colorado law concerning interveners. Opposing counsel first point out in their briefs and in part today during our argument that our full participation somehow violated the parents' rights to due process. This court, actually specifically you, Judge Tallman, in the interest of the AE, a 1996 case, said that due process requires a respondent in a termination hearing to be given notice of the proceeding and an opportunity to be heard or defend and to have the assistance of legal counsel. Such due process rights are satisfied if the respondent has an opportunity to appear through counsel, is given an opportunity to appear through, is given the opportunity to present evidence and cross-examine witnesses through deposition or otherwise.
The respondent there was a parent, I take it.
Yes. And that's what happened in this case. There was absolutely no due process violation. And the county attorney talked about it being a corrupting influence. As the record indicates, this hearing was solely based on not who was the better of the two caregivers, the biological parents, the foster parents, but rather, was there an adjudication? Was an appropriate treatment plan put in place? Did the parents comply with that treatment plan, and were the parents unfit? That is exactly the criteria that the court laid out in its order, and that was exactly the way in which the trial went.
Mr. Eyrick, in your view, is it appropriate for foster parents to argue for termination of parental rights for the natural parents in a DNN case?
Judge, I believe pursuant to the statutory right to intervene, I think when that disposition, when the foster parents believe that the proper disposition is the termination of the parental rights, their concern for the care and protection of the child should allow them to not only come to the court and say, Judge, we think this should happen, but to be able to give some detail as to why. And that's what happened in this case.
Statute says, now that you make me look at it, to provide information or knowledge concerning the care and protection, which could be testimony,
yes,
as opposed to argumentation, which is, I think, what you're talking about now, concerning the placement of the child. Isn't that a distinction that we can draw based on the language?
I don't think it's just that distinction. As this court knows, information is conveyed to the trial court, not just through first-person testimony, but also through cross-examination and through argument. In this case, the foster parents did not call any additional witnesses. All they did was cross-examine and question witnesses that other parties had called.
But you also advocated for termination of the parental rights, did you not?
The foster parents believed that termination of the parental rights was in this child's best interest. Absolutely. And again, in part because looking at the facts in this case, this was a child at the time of termination had been in the foster parents' care for 20 months. He consistently came back from visits with bruises, at least on one or two occasions, came back with, I think as the doctors described, a precipitous loss of weight. And also the underlying facts that led to the filing of the petition, frankly, were so egregious that pursuant to the statute could have been a no appropriate treatment plan. But as I think as Judge Richmond pointed out earlier, is that we have two distinct statutes at stake here. Opposing counsel in our discussion with trial court pointed out or argued that the foster parents' right to be involved should be limited to be heard pursuant, as the judge, as Your Honor pointed out, 1935.02, Section 7. Such person shall have a right to be heard at such hearings or reviews. And the court and the legislature specifically points out in 1935.027 that this statute does not specifically allow the foster parent shall not be made a party to the action for purposes of any hearings or reviews solely on the basis of such notice and right to be heard. Now, as the court did, that distinguishing that from the right to intervene, clearly the right to intervene must mean more than that. And the intervention statute specifically allows a foster parent to come forward with counsel. If the legislature contemplated that all the foster parent was going to do and stand before the judge and say, Your Honor, this child's been in my care for X amount of time and we've had these concerns, there would be absolutely no reason for the legislature to allow a foster parent to come with counsel.
Mr. Eyrick, I'm not clear from what you're saying and from your brief. what actually is the interest of foster parents in a termination proceeding? Because a termination proceeding, as you know, typically involves the natural parents and the statutory goal of reunifying the child or children with the natural parents, if it's possible, and the state's role through the Department of Social Services or Human Services as a parent's patriae to act on behalf of the child, and the GAL's role to enforce that or to see that's effectuated. So what role then does the do the foster parents play in this calculus?
Again, I think it goes back to the care and protection of the child. And in some situations, that care and protection is heightened to the standpoint where they should be able to come before the court pursuant to the statute and say, the only way to keep this child safe is through termination.
But why isn't that role carried out by the Department of Social Services and the GAL? Isn't that their functions?
It should be. Absolutely, it should be.
Well, if it should be, then why is there any need for the foster parents to do anything more than the intervention statute specifies, which is to provide information and knowledge concerning the care and protection of the child?
And again, Your Honor, I believe that advocating does include providing care and information. And this court, in the interest of TD, it's a case from 2006, said that actually the primary focus in dependency neglect cases is not the custodial interest of the parent, but rather the protection and safety of children susceptible to harm from the effects of abuse and neglect. So looking at it, that the focus, the major focus, and again, it's in the interest of TD, 140 Pacific 3rd, 205, this quote is from page 217. Again, it's a 2006 case.
Was that case cited in your brief?
Yeah, I'm not sure it may have been. Would you like me to look?
We can check, that's okay. All right, thank you.
But this court says that is the focus. Not the custodial interest of the parent, but rather the interest is at stake, the concern for the protection and safety of the child. And in this case, which extended well beyond the state and federally mandated expedited permanency planning timeframes, the foster parent had no choice for the sake of his child but to come forward to the court and say, something needs to be done. And that came forward first just in the motion to intervene, and then later to actually fully to participate in the termination hearing. To Your Honor's point about the court having this parent's patriae role, in these cases, as this court knows probably better than anybody, these are hard cases with a lot of conflicting information and a lot of difficult decisions to make as it relates to children and families. The more information trial courts have, the better decisions that are made for children. And in effect, what the foster parents did was provide the trial court with more information. Again, the standard wasn't changed. It was still clear and convincing evidence. It was still followed procedurally the termination statute to the letter.
What is your response to Mr. Slough's point that if your position prevails that in future DNN cases that foster parents will more frequently intervene and seek termination of parental rights or support termination of the parental rights?
I'll say just from a financial standpoint and a practical standpoint, that's probably unlikely. But I would think, and I know different judges have testified to the legislature about this, and I think it's frankly the rationale behind the intervention statute, the more information that trial courts have, the better decisions the courts make for children and families. Now, opposing counsel also talks about the AWR case and says that that case is indicative that we should limit foster parents' rights to intervene again, simply testifying, or to simply saying what they think should happen. And I know Justice Taubman was part of
Judge Taubman.
I'm sorry, Judge Taubman
that's
was
okay.
Part of the was part of the three-court, three-judge panel in that case.
AWR specifically dealt with the rights of former foster parents. In that case, the child had already been returned home from to his parents. There is no pending motion to terminate. The mother, as the evidence was completely clear, was compliant with her treatment plan. And there was no even concurrent plan in place to say if the child's not reunified, it should be termination and adoption. And this case actually is completely opposite. We had a pending motion to terminate. The child, again, at the time of termination, had been out of his parents' care for 20 months in an EPP case. The parents were non-compliant with the treatment plan. And again, in April of 2009, the trial court, with no objection from any party, added a concurrent plan of adoption by non-relative. So it's pretty clear that the AWR case, factually, is in opposite to the facts in this case. The situation that led to the trial court in AWR limiting a foster parent's right to intervene, frankly, had to do with what are the rights of a former foster parent, more so than what are the rights of a foster parent.
Well, as I recall, the division or the opinion in that case discussed case law from other jurisdictions regarding the rights of foster parents and concluded that in other states and the United States Supreme Court have held that the constitutional rights of foster parents are limited in this context. Is that consistent with your understanding of that case?
Judge, it is. And again, the question on that case, again, the foster parents were appealing, and the issue for appeal was, did the foster parents have a due process right to intervene? Again, our intervention was not based on a constitutional right. It was based on a statutory right. But I do think, even following the AWR's analysis, which trails the Matthews v. Eldridge analysis, the foster parents in this case do have a higher liberty interest, or at least constitutional interest, in participating than the parent did in AWR. I actually think AWR lays out a nice analysis in determining when foster parents should be involved and to what extent. And again, I think the analysis was, what was the permanent plan? I think the other language was, had reunification efforts proven unrealistic? That was one of the key points in AWR. In this case, based on the guardian ad litem's motion to terminate, the memorandum of understanding amongst all parties saying, I believe in May of 2009, if the parents do not essentially get in gear, termination of parental rights will occur.
But how can you conclude that the chance of reunification was unrealistic in this case, at least with respect to the mother, where we have the unusual situation of the Department of Social Services actually taking the position that parental rights should not have been terminated?
Well, I think as the court ultimately determined, and the foster parent's position was, is that that position on behalf of the department, frankly, was inaccurate. It was a safety concern if the child would have been returned home to the mother. And again, that plays into the substantial domestic violence issues that were at play in this case. For 20 months, the issue of domestic violence had gone untreated. That was a point that the court brought out in the order. And again, it was one of the reasons that the foster parents came forward and said, we need to intervene for the sake of this child's care and protection. Because in part, the department, who pursuant to the memorandum of understanding in May of 2009, said in writing, we will pursue termination if you do not comply. A month later, there was a domestic violence incident in which the father was arrested. The mother tested positive, had a hot UA in June of 2009, and despite the memorandum of understanding, the department did nothing. Instead, they talked more about reunification, which was inconsistent with the memorandum of understanding. So,
yeah. Mr. Eilert, your 15 minutes are up. If you want to continue, it's at the expense of Mr. Shaner's time, so I'll leave that to you.
Mr. Shaner to step up.
Okay.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Eilert.
May it please the court, counsel, James Shaner, guardian ad litem.
First, I'd like to reiterate for you that the proceedings for the termination hearing in the District Court of Montezuma County did comply with constitutional requirements as well as statutory requirements. There was notice, opportunity for the biological parents to appear. They had counsel, and statutory criteria for termination was met. And that's the position I took in the responsive brief I wrote. Today, you've heard about considerations and constitutional guarantees for the parents, considerations for the foster parents, considerations for County Department of Social Services. I'd like to talk a little bit in terms of considerations for the child. The first thing I look at is 1936043, in which it states, in considering termination, the court shall give primary consideration to the physical, mental, and emotional conditions and needs of the children. That is echoed by 19.3100.5 sub 2, health and safety of the child is of paramount concern. In regard to the involvement of the foster parents in the termination proceedings, it occurs to me the only persons who are involved in a dependent and neglected child case who spend essentially 24/7 with the child are the foster parents. GAL doesn't spend 24/7. Caseworker doesn't spend 24/7 with the child. Foster parents are the ones who are in the trenches and know the issues with the child. A GAL can investigate but not be in the foster home 24/7. A social services caseworker can monitor but not be in a foster home 24/7. Foster parents may disagree with the conclusions of the guardian ad litem. Foster parents may disagree with the conclusions of the Department of Social Services. Because of the considerations of the trial court in giving primary consideration to physical, mental, and emotional conditions and needs, I believe it's essential that any voice that should give the trial court information about that child, it's essential for that trial court to hear that voice.
Seems like there's a dispute about information, Mr. Shaner. It's more a dispute about cross-examination and appearance of counsel and argumentation and taking a position. I mean, can we draw the line between providing information and providing counsel's appearance?
That's what I was just stating. In a situation where foster parents may disagree with what the GAL or the caseworker is saying or doing, that voice may not be heard unless they are represented by counsel and full participants in the hearing. They may not have the skill without counsel to do that themselves. A GAL or a caseworker may not accurately state, even though they may have asked previously what those concerns are of the foster parents, they may not agree with those concerns. It's my position that for a trial court judge, and with these criteria in terms of paramount concerns and primary considerations, that if the foster parents, if you have a situation where the foster parents have information or an opinion that is of vital interest to the child, for the child's best interest, that has to be heard by the trial court.
But nobody appears to disagree with you on that point. As Judge Richman, though, indicated, the question seems to be whether it's appropriate for the foster parents to more expressly advocate for termination of parental rights.
Well, in terms of advocating, I guess in my mind, it's not really a question of should they, because I think, as I stated previously, for a trial court, any voice has value to it. It's maybe when that voice may be heard. Looking at the case law that's been included in all the briefs in this case, you look at a situation where when a termination motion is filed, whether it's by the department, whether it's by the guardian ad litem, that's where the value of the foster parent's voice comes in. I think at earlier times, even if the termination motion is filed right after adjudication, that kicks in there, right? If you have a situation where a permanency plan is includes or is not to return the child in reunification, it may be a concurrent plan or alternate plan for adoption by a non-relative. When that situation where we begin to seriously question whether a parent is going to be able to comply with the treatment plan and have reunification with the child. When that arises, I think that opens the door for the child court to receive any voice and any advocacy in regard to the child.
Mr. Shaner, your time is up.
Thank you.
I want to thank all five lawyers for your fine presentations this morning. Oh, I'm sorry. Judge Jones advised me that correctly that I had jumped a gun. The appellants have 1 minute and 9 seconds left. I apologize.
I don't think I have much, but I'd like to point out two things. This reference, constant reference, to the fact that this child has been in the, been with the foster parents now for approximately 20 months or so, and this has been throughout the trial, and here it's been a big point. And I'd like to point out that they forget the unless clause in that statute. In it's 19.3604C, in one of the subparagraphs where it lists all these different things that the court can consider. But it specifically says, when it talks about being in the, I don't remember the word it uses, but being with the foster care providers for 15 of the last 22 months, so it says it can consider all these things unless. And then you get into one of those subparagraphs there where it specifically says that if any of these delays were attributable to the court proceeding itself or whatever, continuances, and they cannot be attributed to the parent, then, of course, that cannot be considered. So the fact that this, the trial court and the guardian ad litem and the foster parents have advocated that as a big issue, it's my position that under that statute, that it can't be considered in this case because most of the delays occurred, if you recall, around June the 1st of 2009, there was going to be a reunification, but then because of this domestic violence issue, it wasn't. And then up to that point in time, you could maybe attribute all those delays to the parents, but after that, you couldn't. So I'd like to point that out, and I look like I'm out of time. Thank you.
Now we are indeed out of time. Thank you to all five of you. We very much appreciate your arguments. And again, I want to thank the four of you who came from Dolores and Cortez and Mr. Eric, even though you're just here in Denver. We appreciate your argument as well. And I think this is an important case, so we especially appreciate your participation and your assistance to us this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. This concludes the arguments this afternoon for Division 1, and the court will be in recess and the bailiff.